Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. China's new leadership officially takes over in March and will set the agenda for the world's most populous country for the next decade. Changes in the communist government's top tier could affect censorship practices and make it either easier or harder for journalists to report on Chinese issues. With us to discuss the ramifications of the leadership change are the New York Times correspondent in Beijing and the director of the Chinese Studies Center at the University of Sydney. Andrew Jacobs first came to China as a student and later returned to teach English to college students. For more than 4 years now, he's been the capital-based correspondent for the New York Times. Andrew joins us by telephone from New York, where he's visiting. Calling in from Sydney, Australia, is Professor Kerry Brown, Director of China Studies at the University of Sydney. Welcome.
Hi.
So three months have passed since the Communist Party announced that Xi Jinping will take over as the Communist Party chief and will soon take over from Hu Jintao as China's head of state. So Kerry, what can we discern so far? Does he seem to be a reformer?
I think it's really tough to say. First of all, you know, the macroeconomic kind of policies are inherited from what we call the, you know, 12 five-year program, and that goes on until 2015. He's surrounded, obviously, by leaders new and old, and, of course, they have a sort of heavy political influence. And also, you know, the kind of political culture we learned from the fall of Bo Xilai last year is not one that particularly likes, you know, kind of a strong kind of single leaders. It's a consensus-driven system. From what he said in the last few months since becoming party head in November last year, he seems to be a better communicator than Hu Jintao, then that wouldn't be tough to do. And he is also talking quite consistently about the need to really attack corruption. I assume that's because he himself is the son of a former, you know, kind of senior leader, Xi Zhongxun. And in a sense, it's very hard to imagine that he would go against the legacy of his father, who was a supporter of the reform process in the late 70s and early 80s, the economic reform process. And therefore, I think in his heart, he seems to be someone who absolutely accepts the right of the Communist Party to have a monopoly on power, to believe in its historic mission and its link to China becoming a strong, rich country. And therefore, he's attacking corruption because it kind of erodes that legacy, that legitimacy. Whether he's attacking corruption because it is per se not a morally good thing, it's not so clear. And, you know, the challenges that he's really facing and the leadership around him are to restore the legitimacy of the party at a time of great cynicism, great complexity, great dynamism, when the predominant challenges look to be socio-political rather than economic.
Right. And Andrew, do you see any signs of change?
I would agree. There's a lot of talk, and obviously it's a little early to judge too harshly. But I'm not terribly optimistic. I mean, this, you know, you don't get to be the Communist Party chief by you know, making waves. And he's nothing if not a loyalist and a consensus guy. And I think, you know, some of the words he's uttered have been encouraging, but then again, so previous leaders, you know, have uttered things like reform and even sometimes the word political reform. But I don't see him being some closeted guy. Gorbachev is going to, you know, introduce liberal democracy to China.
Speaking of the Russia angle, I was interested to read an article your colleague Chris Buckley wrote last week about Xi Jinping going down to the south of the country and announcing to the public that he's going to be a reformer similar to Deng Xiaoping, but then he had another message to deliver to the Communist Party officials behind closed doors, talking about how the Soviet Union disintegrated, and we don't want to make those same mistakes by becoming too open. And what did you think about that?
I mean,
two faces.
I think that's kind of classic for Chinese leaders. I mean, when he speaks of reform, he's largely referring to economic reform, which is kind of politically safe thing to do. And of course, if he let up at all on the message that, you know, single party rule, I think it would be dangerous to the party's hold on power. So I think, you know, that he's doing what is to be expected, I think, of the leader of a party that, you know, has monopoly on power.
Okay, let's move a little bit to the media and the possible impact on the flow of information to and from China. Kerry, have the tactics employed against foreign news outlets changed over the years, and what do you see coming up?
Yeah, I mean, they've changed radically. Last 20 years, I think the whole situation has completely transformed. You had a situation before of materially and institutionally far greater control over, you know, publication, physical publication, but with the introduction of electronic communication, that has fundamentally changed. And the velocity of that has changed. I mean, when I first started dealing with China in 1998, there were probably 3 million people on the internet. And now, you know, maybe a billion if you include mobile users. So China is a profoundly networked country in terms of social media. And I think what social media gives us in China through Weibo and Weixin and other kind of platform is a map of the complexity of Chinese public opinion, different constituencies, different subgroups, different kind of, you know, sorts of voices. It isn't straightforward. It isn't just a battle between, you know, kind of government elite or a party elite and then sort of opponent kind of groups. It's often, you know, an incredibly sort of, you know, kind of fluid situation where over issues where there is acceptance of public debate, like corruption, like, you know, government efficiency, like public participation in decision making, you kind of have a range of voices speaking in, you know, very different ways sometimes. Sometimes they are able to speak in very coded ways. Mm-hmm. There's a tiny area where, you know, you're actually sort of, you know, attacking the, you know, kind of legitimacy of the party where you will attract unpleasant state, you know, kind of intrusion. But in many other areas, you are, you know, people are able to communicate, are able to speak. And I think that this is going to become one of the kind of fundamental drivers of, you know, kind of how Chinese society evolves and develops. And that's why the Nobel Prize winner, Liu Xiaobo, who is now in jail in China, and said, you know, in a way, God created the internet for China. For such a profoundly networked society, anyway, people are able to create their own networks, almost kind of indifferent to government. And that's an extraordinary thing. That's an absolutely remarkable thing.
And, Andrew, do you think that, that this social media revolution, so to speak, will force change in China?
I think it will. It's all about the speed. I think it already is to a certain extent. I think what you're seeing, you know, in terms of corruption, the attention to and a crackdown on certain kinds of corruption, I think that's all about social media, bloggers, people on Weibo, who, you know, use information, you know, maybe given to them by someone, a disgruntled colleague, to push, you know, to promote information and then forcing the authorities to act on that information about, you know, about a corrupt official. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty, you know, and that's raised awareness about corruption and also given people a sense that they something they can do about it. I mean, it's a fleeting sense, but it gives people a sense of empowerment. You know, there's obviously limits to what people can say, and it, you know, the line is usually drawn at advocating, you know, the end of single party rule or advocating, mm-hmm. You know, introducing democracy, that kind of thing. So there's clear lines, but people are constantly pushing against those lines, and it's, you know, it's an extraordinary thing to watch. You know, I think it'll take quite a few years before we see kind of fundamental change politically, but in the meantime, there's definitely been an impact on certain kinds of issues.
Right. And one interesting case that you wrote about was the Zhu Rufeng. Can you talk about that and the role of bloggers? And...
Well, he's called, you know, calls himself a citizen journalist. Who basically, you know, he relies on tips from people, as I mentioned, kind of disgruntled associates or jilted lovers or people who want to get revenge on some high level official, or not even high level, could be even low level officials, and he takes these tips, or usually in the case of an official in Southwest China, it was sex videos that he was having sex with some mistress in a hotel, and he publishes these videos and quickly brought about the guy's downfall. Mm-hmm. So these are the kinds of these kind of people kind of tread a very thin ice, and you know, for now he's still doing what he does, but he's frequently attacked or has his website blocked, and he was interrogated a few weeks ago by the police. So, but it has a pretty discernible impact. I mean, it's pretty impressive.
And Kerry, what's your take on the this Zhu Rufeng case and those similar to his?
Well, I mean, there's lots of tension between officials and the public. That's been intensifying over the last few years. I think the idea of a sort of benign, morally upright government official is now regarded as a bit of an oxymoron. You know, a kind of an official isn't going to be like that. And I guess the sort of extraordinary thing about social media and a kind of more diverse, less government-controlled press is you have a sort of way of influencing officials, making them more fearful of what they do. Corruption is still very high in China. I mean, government officials at provincial, at sort of county, and certainly at village level, have enormous amounts of powers. And so, there's a sort of big problem in articulating the line between what sort of right for them to do when they're kind of acting in a very entrepreneurial way in the shadows, as it were, and when they're absolutely kind of acting according to larceny and sort of greed. This is a system in which, the forces of productivity economically have unleashed money-making powers. The Communist Party of China is probably the world's greatest money-making machine. Structurally, it's quite similar to Facebook or Apple or even, the Catholic Church. It has a sort of incredibly good grasp of its key strategic objective, and that is economic growth. Like Apple with, kind of making money and Facebook with having sort of billions and billions of users. It has the organizational kind of structure to deliver that. The problem really is in an era in which, kind of expectations, certainly for urban people in China, I mean like in Shanghai, for instance, towards government service and an emerging Chinese middle class, they're very high. They expect a lot from the government in terms of welfare and in terms of provision of public goods. They're fussy about their consumption choices. They are, as someone I think recently wrote about Shanghai, people whose consumption patterns show, incredible sort of narcissism and self-centeredness in a way. And, the kind of ways in which states can, sort of intervene there and, sort of try and influence behavior are, like anywhere, pretty limited. It's do they have the kinds of, ways of, sort of incentivizing people or controlling people? And I think what we see in these expose cases is a lot of, distrust of officials, a lot of dislike, a lot of envy sometimes. Mm-hmm. But also, the kind of means of really drawing blood. If you do want to expose a government official that's crossed your path, that the means are there in ways that didn't exist in the past. And I think that's a sort of remarkable new dynamic that these kinds of, sort of public figures can really be hurt by flesh searches and other things on the internet. And unless you put a lot of structural strategic effort into it, it's really tough to control it.
If Kerry, I want to just, I know you have to take off soon, but I wanted to ask you what you see as the, say, the top three challenges in the coming decade facing these this new leadership socially, economically, and internationally.
Well, I think the domestic one, they've said again and again, and it's really the case of implementing it, and that is to, you know, create structures for rule of law in which the powers of party officials or others in power in China are held accountable to more diverse power sources. This creates greater stability. We saw with the Bolshevik case, you have real problems with ad hoc kind of sort of dispensation of state power, and you need more predictability to grow the economy, to grow the political system. Rule of law is absolutely fundamental. Rule by law. I mean, that's the sort of Chinese iteration of it. I think the second thing is, we are almost certainly entering into an era of greater socio-political change. I mean, the social changes are happening. The political changes mean, greater role for civil society, a need for, their kind of legal enfranchisement, and, public participation in decision-making because of the enormous complexity and diversity of this continent-sized country and its constituencies. And so, a kind of real major effort to try and create some greater dialogue in power and sort of distributions of power between, the party and, the kinds of the citizens, as it were. This is an obviously, massive problem. Leaders last year were looking at Tocqueville's, kind of history of the American and the French Revolution and sort of really wondering, are they getting close to a revolutionary moment when the choices are so stark that, certain groups in society will simply rise up. I think the third thing is to, kind of, and this links to the international and the domestic, a communicative leadership. I mean, Hu Jintao was not a communicator. Xi Jinping needs to communicate China's vision of what it is in the future, what its, kind of role in the world will be, what is the positive thing that China brings, the sort of global community. And, domestically, he needs to, kind of articulate to Chinese people, the vision of what China is within itself. As one Chinese expert said to me in Shanghai last year, we don't know who we are. You expect us to say who we are. We don't know who we are. And I guess sort of like a political leader has to kind of answer that in a way, saying, well, China, this is what China is. This is the values it represents. This is the sort of vision it has for it and its role in the world as it will become, one of the major, well, it is one of the major powers of the 21st century and almost certainly will continue in that role.
Right. Well, thank you, Kerry. And
thanks so much.
Now, Andrew, what are your top three, and could you maybe give some examples of why you think they're the big challenges?
Well, I agree with everything Kerry said, and I would circle back to corruption. I think there's a lot of cynicism in among Chinese people right now, and I think what's feeling it especially is the sense that their leaders are hopelessly corrupt, and I think the party needs to get a handle on that. But the problem is that how do you when corruption is so endemic and officials rise because they are part of this corrupt cabal and they make payments to get promotions and they receive bribes to kind of lead a lifestyle that they think they deserve. I mean, how do you tackle that without destroying the party? So that's going to be a challenge, is tackling corruption in a meaningful way without actually bringing about, the demise of the party or maybe causing a revolt within the party. I mean, there's some of the proposals include, requiring officials to disclose their assets. And people, a lot of officials are dead opposed to that. They don't want to have to, and some of the cases that have come out in the last few weeks, of relatively low-level officials owning dozens of apartments, across the country, and they just have so much cash they don't know what to do with it. They just buy up apartments or homes, and so that's one challenge. And I think Kerry touched on this kind of this values or this sense of what are we, and Xi Jinping has talked about, he's uttered this phrase about the Chinese renaissance or the Chinese renewal, the idea that there's this return to this great nation, the Chinese dream, but it's really just kind of an empty phrase. It's not, you know, people don't really know what he means. You know, and it's not about, you know, if you were to say the American dream, you have the idea of a kind of individual pursuit of happiness and a car and a house. And I think no one in China is really sure what that Chinese dream is. What's the renewal he's referring to? And I think there's kind of a spiritual kind of crisis in China now about, okay, we are emerging as one of the, you know, we are a great world power, but what do we stand for? You know, and that sort of trickles down through society, the sense that there's not a lot of trust in other people, and people don't have a lot of trust in each other or their government. So I think, you know, and then there's the issue of the wealth gap, and this kind of slightly touches on corruption, but there are a lot of super, super wealthy people who are not shy about flaunting their wealth, but there are many more people who live on, you know, the equivalent of $1.50 a day. And I think that, you know, China has a dangerously a broad wealth gap. I think it's... Right. You know, officially it's not as large as most people think it is, but, you know, unofficially it's one of the world's largest, and dangerously so. And I think there's the risk of instability, as, you know, if that's not addressed.
Right. A lot of those are migrant workers that are struggling to integrate into urban China. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's, you know, another issue is that urban migrants or most Chinese don't have the freedom to they can move to another city, but they get none of the benefits that urban residents get. So, for example, if they get sick, they have to pay out of pocket to go to a hospital in the city. If their kids, once their kids hit high school, their kids have to leave, for example, Beijing, and have to go back to their ancestral home to go to school, usually a far inferior school. And it makes it sets these people out to be kind of second-class citizens. They have much, they enjoy less the fruits of the government of in terms of benefits and social welfare, and so that's something that breeds a lot of anger in people.
Right.
And that's a challenge as China becomes more urbanized. You know, now it's 51% urban, and then it's a huge shift from a few years ago. So it's going to increasingly, you know, they have to address this issue. And they've talked about it, but so far we've seen no evidence that that's going to happen.
Now, I'd like to talk a bit about some of your personal experiences in China, but before we continue our discussion, I'd want to remind everyone that you can listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on the website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org. or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. That's Global JOURN. So when you talk to people and you're back in New York and they ask you, how has China changed since you went there as a student and a teacher, what do you tell them?
I mean, it's dizzying. It's an immense, the change is incredible. And largely economic, but also social change. I mean, when I was there in the 80s, you know, Chinese had a lot less social freedom. They get a passport was very difficult. To marry and divorce, there was a lot of meddling with the state. Certainly having children, that hasn't changed that much. You know, the government intrudes in that people's ability to have more than one child. But people, you know, can conduct their lives pretty freely in many ways, as long as they don't, you know, criticize the state. And of course the prosperity is sometimes overwhelming. You know, even now I've been there 4.5 years, I still can't get over it.
Yeah.
But there is, you know,
what's an example of the great wealth?
I lived in New York for many years. I've never seen more luxury cars than in Beijing, and I've been all over the world. I mean, just you see an excessive number of Lamborghinis, super $200,000 to $500,000 designer cars, because every car there, a foreign car, has a tax that essentially doubles the price of the car. I mean, so many, many, you know, Audis, BMWs, Mercedes, you get the sense from people, your friends, that a lot of the people driving those cars are not so much self-made millionaires, but there's a very persistent sense that a lot of people driving those cars got rich through to maybe dishonest right. ways, and there's a lot of resentment.
Right, and I want to close on the hacking case. There have been recent articles talking about how Chinese hackers have attacked the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, revealing problems and cybersecurity issues in the existing in the journalism field. Were you personally ever hacked? As you're reporting from Beijing?
I was a few years ago. I had a Yahoo account that I used that was hacked. I don't know how long it had been, but I suddenly realized that all my emails were being forwarded to a strange address. I got into my settings and noticed it. And, you know, all of that, I mean, the rash of hacking cases in the last few months, you know, are disturbing, but a lot of us aren't surprised. We've always assumed our emails are not private. I think we conduct ourselves with that in mind. We conduct our correspondence with that in mind, and we don't have very sensitive conversations with sources or friends. And but I think I think that what we're seeing with not just hacking email, just hacking into computer systems, U.S. infrastructure. I think it's a huge problem that I think is finally beginning some attention. I don't know if the U.S. government will act on it, but I think it's
That's an intriguing point to close on. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Joining us today were Andrew Jacobs of the New York Times and Kerry Brown from the University of Sydney. Our program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Anchi Du was the lead producer. Stay with us for Free Press Watch, and please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Kelly Moffitt. This week's news comes from Argentina, Uzbekistan, and the Committee to Protect Journalists. Federal judges in Argentina are now reviewing the country's controversial Audiovisual Media Act, according to the newspaper Página 12. The new media law limits the number of radio and TV licenses that one company can hold and places restrictions on broadcasters' audience reach. Large media groups in Argentina, such as Grupo Clarín, have accused the government of Cristina Fernández de Kirchner of attempting to overregulate the country's broadcast industry and limit free speech. The Kirchner administration says the law is actually an attempt to democratize media ownership and modernize existing laws. The judges will have 60 days to determine whether or not the law is constitutional. In Uzbekistan, news has finally come out about journalists serving 12.5-year prison sentence on phony extortion charges. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Dilmurad Said secretly passed an encoded note about physical and mental abuses suffered in jail. This confirms years of suspicions held by human rights groups that Uzbek detainees are tortured and forced to undergo psychiatric treatments while imprisoned, which is a direct violation of Uzbek constitution and criminal code. Despite repeated requests for information, Uzbek authorities have not officially updated human rights organizations on the location or condition of Said and three other journalists currently imprisoned in the country. The Committee to Protect Journalists released its annual Attacks on the Press report last week. Not surprisingly, Syria, Pakistan, and Iran atop the list of countries where press freedom is at the highest risk. Other countries considered burgeoning democracies such as Brazil and Turkey also made the list. For more information on these stories and other events concerning press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalists. I'm Kelly Moffitt. See you next week.